Welcome to the Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine. Meet him, greet him, treat him, and street him. Today's date is March 7th, 2015, and I am your skeptical host, Ken Milne. The title of today's podcast is Bang Your Head, Pediatric Concussions. And our guest skeptic, you'll recognize him, it's Dr. Anthony Crocco. Anthony is an associate professor, McMaster University, the medical director and division head of McMaster's Children's Hospital's Emergency Department. Welcome back to the SGEM, Anthony.
Thank you, Ken. It's great to be back, and welcome to McMaster Children's Hospital.
It's great being in the hammer. But you know what, Anthony? I've got a question. Why are your episodes so hugely popular?
You know what, Ken? I'm going to give you all the credit for that. You do a great job prepping these things. I think also pediatric emergency as a topic for most general emergency physicians is something that makes most people, including me, a little bit anxious. So I'm really thankful to your audience for listening in.
Well, the last one you did was on fever, and it had to be one of the most downloaded, viewed, and shared episodes. Can you summarize those three papers we did into five take-home points?
Absolutely. So point number one, antipyretics don't appear to lengthen duration of fever in ill children. Number two, antipyretics can be combined for effect, but to what end? Number three, antipyretics don't appear to decrease the risk of febrile seizure recurrence. Number four, fever is not your enemy. And number five, and by far the most important point, is that parents and caregivers should focus on patient comfort instead of focusing on trying to normalize the temperature in febrile children.
Thanks, Anthony. I think that's great. That last one, that number five, parents, they just focus on that number, and they really should just focus in on their child's comfort.
100%, and it's our job to educate them to that effect.
All right, well, let's start this episode off with a case scenario. What do you got for me today?
So this week, we've got an 11-year-old snowboarder who fails to land an epic jump. She was wearing a helmet, there was a brief loss of consciousness, and she is amnestic to the event, although it was recorded on video. The only complaint is a mild headache. Her examination is normal, and a shared decision is made to observe her rather than getting a CT scan. She's ultimately diagnosed with a concussion, but when leaving the department, she wants to know when can she go back to shredding.
Yeah, excellent. All right, why don't we give some information on concussions in the pediatric population?
Okay, well, pediatric traumatic brain injury, or TBI, is a leading cause of death and disability. The CDC has called it a national health problem.
TBIs are responsible for close to 500,000 emergency department visits, over 35,000 hospitalizations, and more than 7,000 deaths per year in the United States.
In addition, TBI is considered to be mild 75% of the time. Most patients with TBI are discharged from the emergency department with active concussive symptoms.
And TBI represents a very challenging situation to emergency physicians. I mean, we don't want to miss that significant intracranial lesion, while at the same time, we want to avoid ionizing radiation.
So how do you decide when to get neuroimaging? The best clinical decision instrument, and the one we use here at McMaster Children's Hospital, is PCARN. It has been externally validated and found to be better than the UK Chalice rule and the Canadian Catch rule.
PCARN has been collecting data on patients with head trauma since 2004, over 10 years. It's a federally funded, multi-institutional network for research in pediatric emergency medicine.
They successfully enrolled 34,000 patients for the derivation of two clinical decision rules, one for children less than 2 years and one for children 2 years or older, and an additional 9,000 patients to validate the decision rules. This was published by Cooperman et al. In The Lancet 2009.
Assuming no patients with significant intracranial injuries were missed with their follow-up mechanism, the rule had the following to predict the lack of clinically important traumatic brain injury. 97% sensitivity and 59% specificity for older children, so that's two and older. And then 99% sensitivity and 54% specificity for the younger age groups, and those were less than 2 years of age.
The overall prevalence of clinically important traumatic brain injury was 0.9%, or less than 1 in 100. Patients requiring neurosurgery was 0.14%, or 1 in 700. And no patients died out of 34,000.
So you know what I'll do, Anthony? I'll put up a couple of pocket cards in the show notes that summarize the PCARN CT head decision guide. But let's get on to the clinical question. What is it that we're asking today?
So today we're asking the question, is there benefit to recommending strict rest after a child has a concussion?
And what reference do you have for this?
We're looking at Thomas et al. Benefits of Strict Rest After Acute Concussion, a randomized controlled trial in Pediatrics, January 2015.
And you know that we go through a PICO statement. So what was the population we were dealing with?
So the population for this study were patients aged 11 to 22 years old, presenting to the emergency department with acute, meaning less than 24 hours, diagnosis of concussion.
And their exclusion criteria were the patients couldn't speak English, they couldn't consent, had pre-existing intellectual disability or mental health issue, had a previously diagnosed intracranial injury, or were going to be admitted to the hospital.
In addition, patients were also excluded if they lived more than 1 hour from the investigation center or at the discretion of the recruiting physician.
So what was the intervention, Anthony?
So they looked at strict rest at home for 5 days, meaning no school, work, or activity, followed by a stepwise return to activity.
And what did they compare it to?
They compared it to rest for 1 to 2 days at the discretion of the treating physician, followed by a return to school and stepwise return to activity.
And what was their outcome?
They looked at compliance with physical and mental activity recommendations, as well as symptoms, neurocognitive performance using the impact, and balance.
So the author's conclusions were, quote, recommending strict rest for adolescents immediately after concussion offered no added benefit over the usual care. End of quote. Well, Anthony, let's probe the literature for quality. And we've got 11 questions for randomized clinical control trials. So question number one, was the study population focused on those that we see in the emergency department?
Yes. The patients were aged 11 to 22 years, so not strictly pediatric by most standards. And here we see patients up to and including 17 years of age, after which they really don't exist for me as a clinician.
All right. Number two, the patients, were they adequately randomized?
They were.
Was the randomization process concealed?
It was.
Did they analyze the patients in the group to which they were randomized?
They did.
And the study patients, did they recruit them consecutively?
No, they didn't, Ken.
Okay, so we'll talk about that. The patients in both groups, were they similar with respect to prognostic factors?
They weren't.
How about the participants? Were they unaware of the group allocation?
No, they couldn't be because of the methods involved in this study.
Okay. Number eight, all groups, were they treated equally except for the intervention?
We're not sure about this one.
Number nine, was follow-up complete, at least 80% for both groups?
It was.
And did they consider patient-important outcomes?
Not entirely.
And the last question, number 11, the treatment effect, was it large enough and precise enough to be clinically significant?
It was.
All right, so let's go through the key results. Here's some of them. Both groups reported an approximately 20% decrease in physical activity and energy expenditure for the 5 days post-injury.
There was more reported high and moderate mental activity in the usual care group on days 2 to 5.
And with regards to efficacy, 67% or two-thirds of patients in the usual care group experienced symptom resolution during the follow-up compared to 63% in the strict group. So there was no difference.
Yeah, it took 3 days longer for 50% of patients in the strict group to report symptom resolution. The strict group had more post-concussive symptoms compared to the usual care group over the 10-day follow-up period, 70 versus 50, and that was significant, and had greater post-concussive symptom scale scores.
And there was no significant difference noted in computer-based neurocognitive tests and balance scores noted, and no significant difference in neuropsychological assessments except for the symbol digit modality test, for which the usual group performed worse at day 3 and better at day 10. But let's comment on this study.
Overall, Ken, I'd say this is a novel single-center study examining a topic that we often struggle with in the emergency department. Specifically, how long do you keep someone resting after they've had a concussion?
Yeah, and there's some minor limitations of this study. The patients were aged 11 to 22 years. It's questionable whether this study can be generalized to those younger than 11 years of age.
Yeah, and the two groups did differ significantly in terms of age, with the strict rest group being older. The impact of this is really unknown.
And the outcome measures such as representation to the emergency department and proportion of patients with symptoms beyond 10 days was not described. In addition, 11% of patients were lost to follow-up.
This study's really opened the door to a very interesting line of inquiry, and further research will be useful. For the time being, however, there is evidence to support a 2-day rest period following a concussion with a gradual return to activity.
Keeping a child at strict rest for 5 days post-concussion appears to offer no benefit, and there is evidence of harm from this strategy. So what did you think, Anthony, comparing what our assessment was to the actual author's conclusions?
I would agree with the authors that there is no added benefit to 5 days of strict rest over 2 days, and we would add that the 5-day strict strategy appears to cause more harm.
So can you give me an SGEM bottom line?
In children with concussion, 2 days of rest followed by a gradual return to activity is preferred over 5 days of rest followed by a gradual return to activity. The longer strict rest period appears to cause more post-concussive symptoms.
How about you give us a case resolution then?
I think we're good to send this shredder home with your hospital's standard concussive information and a couple days of rest.
So how are you going to take this actual research paper and apply it clinically?
In children in the emergency department presenting with concussion, we can limit the rest period post-concussion to 2 days followed by a gradual return to activity.
So what are you going to tell your patient, but in this case, probably the parent or caregiver?
What I'm going to say is, look, your child has a concussion and they need to take a couple days off school and sports. After that, they can slowly return to activity as they tolerate over a period of time.
Wait, stop. We're not going to do the Keener contest just yet. Anthony, can I squeeze a twofer out of you?
Excuse me, Ken?
A twofer? Two for the price of one. Your shows are so popular, and last time we did 3 papers. Do you think we could cover 1 small pediatric paper on concussion?
Well, we have a special here at McMaster Children's Hospital today. It is 2-for-1 day, so let's go ahead and do it.
2-for-1 day in the hammer. Excellent. Okay, let's talk about the same case of the 11-year-old snowboarder who has this mild headache after her concussion. The mother wants to know if there is anything else besides acetaminophen or ibuprofen to treat her child's headache. So what's the clinical question?
So the clinical question is, what about using intravenous hypertonic saline as a therapy for pediatric concussive pain?
Excuse me? Hypertonic saline?
Yeah, Ken. Hypertonic saline as a therapy for increased intracranial pressure was first described 95 years ago.
Wow, I did not know that, okay? 95 years. It sure demonstrates a KT window, or a knowledge translation window, of a little bit more than 10 years. But you must have a reference for this.
We're looking at Lumbra Brown et al. Hypertonic saline as a therapy for pediatric concussive pain, a randomized controlled trial of symptom treatment in the emergency department. And this showed up in pediatric emergency care March 2014.
So what was the population?
They looked at children 4 to 17 years old with acute closed head injury. Their GCS had to be greater than 13, and they had to have moderate to severe concussive symptoms and have had a CT scan prior to enrollment.
So they excluded the GCSs of less than 13. The CT showed a bleed. There was a seizure, chronic migraines, alcohol or drugs, associated injuries, needing narcotics, trauma patients, intubated, or pregnant. So what was the intervention, Anthony?
The intervention in this study was standard care plus 10 cc's per kilogram of 3% hypertonic saline with a maximum of 1 liter given over an hour.
And what did they use as a control?
The control group also had standard care, but in this case they got 10 cc's per kilogram of normal saline with a maximum of 1 liter also given over 1 hour.
And what was their outcome?
Their primary outcome was a change in self-reported pain using the Wong-Baker Faces Pain Rating Scale.
And that's a pretty common pediatric pain scale?
100%. If you guys haven't seen it, it's worth looking at. It's actually very useful for pediatric pain measurement.
Okay, well, I'll throw the scale up in the show notes. Any secondary outcomes?
Yeah, they looked at change in pain, nausea, vomiting, other symptoms of concussion within 2 to 3 days of presentation.
All right, so the author's conclusions were, quote, 3% hypertonic saline is more effective than normal saline in acutely reducing concussion pain in children. End of quote. Well, we've got 11 quality checklist questions to go through, so let's burn through those quickly. Number one, were these ED patients?
Yes, they were. They were recruited from a tertiary care pediatric emergency department.
Were they randomized?
Yeah, computer randomization was used.
Did they hide the randomization?
They concealed it.
And the patients, were they analyzed in the groups which they were randomized?
They certainly did.
Did they recruit consecutively?
No, they didn't, Ken. Patients were recruited by convenience sample, and recruiting changed in the last 6 months to alternating 2-week blocks per month. Apparently, there was another study going on at the same center needing the same patients, and so they had to share them.
Yeah, that sometimes happens in research.
It does.
All right, well, were the patients similar in both groups?
No, they weren't. there was significantly higher pain in the hypertonic saline group at the onset and a higher level of analgesic use in the hypertonic saline group prior to enrollment.
How about blinding?
They were blinded. Patients and caregivers were both blinded to allocation.
Did they treat both groups equally?
Hard to say here, Ken. Although both groups received standard care, differences in this care are not specified.
How about the follow-up? Was it complete?
It was.
And were patient important outcomes considered?
Unsure. Although short-term symptoms were looked at, we are unsure of the long-term effect of hypertonic saline on neurocognitive healing post-concussion.
How about the treatment effect? Was it large enough and precise enough to be clinically significant?
Unsure here too. Although a statistically significant difference was noted in the change in pain scores benefiting the hypertonic saline group, this difference is really questionable given the major limitations of this study.
All right, so let's go through the key results. The change in pain from pre-treatment to 1 hour post-treatment was significantly better at 3.5 for the hypertonic saline group than 1.1 for the normal saline group.
In addition, the change in pain at 2 to 3 days was significantly better in the hypertonic saline group compared to the normal saline group.
All right, so let's talk about this. Let's comment on it. This study explores an interesting therapeutic possibility for children with moderate to severe concussions after an acute head injury. The author's conclusions are a little overambitious, and careful consideration of the paper's limitations need to be addressed.
So one of the major limitations, and I would say the biggest flaw in this study, is that the sample size was too small. The original plan was to recruit a total of 104 patients for this trial. The authors failed to reach this number and only recruited a total of 44 patients. The low number of patients puts the study at risk of significant differences between the study groups, which we see. Specifically in this study, the hypertonic saline group had a higher initial pain score, which could make it easier to see a greater absolute change in pain over time.
Yeah, and there's also a problem here, Anthony, with generalizability. You know, this study only included patients who had a CT scan, and therefore it's questionable whether these results can be applied to all patients presenting with concussive symptoms. Also, it'd be unethical to perform an unnecessary CT scan just to ensure the utility of this therapy. The authors also had a number of exclusion criteria, including post-traumatic seizure and a history of chronic migraine, which may preclude the generalizing of these results to an average ED patient.
Yeah, and a third thing I would have to add is that follow-up was not as planned. The initial plan was a 2 to 3 day follow-up. The average follow-up was 5 days, and many patients being followed at 7 days. This may have instilled recall bias, undermining the results from the 2 to 3 day pain scales.
So what do you think about the authors' conclusions?
I'm going to have to respectfully disagree with the authors. Based on significant limitations within this study, hypertonic saline intravenously is not ready for primetime use in patients with moderate to severe concussion.
So what's the SGEM bottom line?
Although an interesting therapeutic modality to be further studied, intravenous hypertonic saline is not ready for routine use in children with moderate to severe concussion.
And so what's the clinical application then?
Well, there's not really any clinical application for this at this time. I mean, like maybe nebulized hypertonic saline will work for kids with bronchiolitis and happen to have moderate to severe concussion. But really, and then, you know, all joking aside, this isn't ready for prime time.
Okay, now we can come to the Keener contest. Last week's winner was
Chris Belcher from Kentucky. He knew that ketamine was originally called CI-581.
Anthony, what's the Keener contest this week?
So PCARN is a Pediatric Emergency Care Applied Research Network. It is the first federally funded, multi-institutional network for research in pediatric emergency medicine in the United States. This week's question is, what is the Canadian equivalent of PCARN?
I noticed there that you put your game show voice on just then. This time? Did you notice that? You put a game show voice
on. Well,
you
know, I got to ham it up a little bit.
All right. Well, if you know the Canadian version of the PCARN, send me an email, thesgem@gmail.com, with Keener in the subject line. The first person to provide the correct answer will, as always, receive a cool skeptical prize. Now, I just want to remind everybody about some conferences coming up. There's the Rural and Remote Medicine course. That's April 9th to 11th. In Montreal, Quebec. Then there's Steel Beam in Hamilton, Ontario, April 20th to 21st.
We've also got Lighting the Way, CAPE 2015, being held in Edmonton, Alberta, May 30th to June 3rd.
And then we have SMAC, Chicago, Illinois, June 23rd to 26th. Thanks again, Anthony, for being a guest skeptic and doing a twofer on the SGEM.
Hey, my pleasure, Ken, and thanks for coming out and visiting me here in Hamilton, Ontario.
You know, one question, Anthony, I always get from listeners is they're wondering, when are you going to do another Rantthony?
I know I've been promising this for a while, but I am working on a painfully awesome rant.
Well, until we can get that done, can you give the SGEM tagline in a rant?
You know what? You got to remember to be skeptical of anything you learn, even if you heard it here on The Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine.
That is one ranting pediatric emerge doc. Talk to everyone next week.